we're back.
It's the Linux Show, and we're live broadcasting at www.linuxshow.com. If you hear a little noise in the background, it's because one of our panelists is at the airport joining us tonight. But we'll do the best we can and bring you this show. It's February the 10th, 2004, second show of February for 04. We're going to have most of the panel here with us tonight. We still haven't gotten hooked up with Doc Searles yet, but the rest of the panel is here. Arnie, you're still at school right now, that's correct?
That's right, I'm in my classroom. I'm in H106 Fontana High School, and unfortunately my computer is at the other end of the classroom, and that's going to be rectified tomorrow, so I can't do IRC tonight and talk on the phone simultaneously. That will be fixed.
Okay, and again, that background noise that you might be hearing, that's Russ Pavlicek. Russ, what airport are you at right now?
I'm in beautiful Atlanta, where I have been residing for the past few hours and where I will be still residing for a few hours once the show's over.
And you are on the way to...
Minneapolis.
Minneapolis.
Yes, who would have thought that from Maryland to Minneapolis would turn into a 14-hour flight? But that's basically what I'm looking at right now.
Now, see, Russ, you've missed out. You forgot to tell them to put the snow skids on the tires of the plane, and then there would be no problem at all getting to Minneapolis.
Yeah, well, I have found that apparently there's only three airports in the entire country that fly to Minneapolis, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, Detroit is one.
Well, you know, it's like I didn't realize that Minneapolis was that, you know, so unfavorable in the world, but it's apparently very hard to find flights to get that end up there. I don't quite understand this phenomenon. But.
Well, I mean, this is February, and Minneapolis is where the you know, what they call Alberta Clippers come through there regularly, and they bring tons of snow, and
that's it.
Yeah.
So here I sit in Atlanta.
Yeah, no, you can get a flight to Minneapolis anytime you want in the winter, but unfortunately it's on a de Havilland Otter, you know, which is like a bush plane.
You see in Chicago or, you know, the Wisconsin market, nobody flies to Minnesota this time of year. You take the train.
Yeah. Oh, then you get stuck in the snow, too. I've done that.
But, well, it's a heck of a lot more reliable than flying, but...
Well, I'll tell you, here we got.
You also take the dog sled, I think. That would probably be the best.
Yeah, that's always an option. Well, let's go ahead and jump on into segment one. Let's go directly to you, Russ. I want to give you some time before the battery on your cell phone dies. And if you do have a chance, feel free to hang up after you've covered your stories and... go find yourself a payphone and call back in and join in on the discussion for segment number two, for sure. But why don't we go ahead and jump right on you, right to you right away, so we can cover your major news stories of the evening.
Okay, I have three of them listed, and I remember what two of them are. I don't remember what the first one is at the moment, but maybe Jeff can look it up if he gets a chance. But the two that kind of struck me the most... in recent times. One of them was one I actually wrote over at processor.com talking about some of the recent prognostications about whether Microsoft will become a Linux software company and why I don't think that's going to happen. And that's something I've talked about here on the show before. But it was interesting that just before, or actually just about the same time that my article came out, there was a story over on, I think it's NewsForge, an interview with the head of OSDL saying why he believes that Microsoft would be producing Linux software. This is about, you know, the sixth time that I've seen that prediction here inside the last 5 or 6 weeks, you know, the beginning of the year. Has brought a lot of these predictions, but quite frankly, I still think that they're all missing the boat. I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon, and I don't think it's going to happen particularly while Gates and Ballmer are at the helm of the company.
Why is that, Russ?
Well, the bottom line is this. You know, there are two cash cows in Microsoft. There is Windows and there is Office. Their whole methodology of making money has to do with locking in the customer into the solution. And in fact, I found it quite amusing. I got a postcard from Microsoft about a week ago proclaiming that they're going to be teaching some seminar on basically how to lock in your customers.
I got one of those too.
It was quite appropriate for the timing of my piece. But you know, this is what they're used to, and you still have, and you know, if you break the lock in, and it starts with Office, you know, they get the organization's building on Office. You have to have Word, you have to have PowerPoint, you got to stay up to date, yada yada yada, and that ends up selling a whole slew of other applications, including Windows and including everything else that goes to support a Windows infrastructure. So it's this one gigantic cascade. Once you break that lock-in, once you put, say, Office on Linux, suddenly all of that revenue, that fallout revenue, goes away. It's just not going to be there. So, number one, it will damage the cash flow from the number two cash cow in the company, Windows. Another piece of it is that you have two entrepreneurs still at the helm. And we've seen this over and over again that when a company matures, a lot of the time it gets rid of the entrepreneur and puts in a more traditional manager, because the entrepreneurs often cannot bring themselves to kill favorite children once they get old in the marketplace. And that's basically what this would amount to, that it would mean sacrificing certain things for the profit that could possibly be made off of Office on Linux. And so I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon, as long as Gates and Ballmer are at the helm. I just don't think it's going to happen. Now, I noticed that when this thing was cross-posted, my article particularly was cross-posted over at Linux Today, there were some people out there that were commenting that there is no market for Office on Linux, that, you know, we're not going to switch, blah, blah, blah. And for the people that are using Linux and open source for philosophical reasons, like most of the people listening to the broadcast probably, yeah, that's quite true. You're not going to be using that. However, we're finally in the case where it's no longer early adopter. We're seeing mainstream adoptions in business. And frankly, business is doing this because it makes other sense, economic sense, business sense. And they don't care. They would love to have Office for Linux for the simple reason that it would make the transition easier. So there is a market out there, regardless of what some people say, but I don't believe that we're going to see Microsoft try to fill it anytime soon.
Yeah, well, I agree with you in the short term, but I do not agree with you in the long term at all. I think as much as we pick on Gates and Ballmer, the people who are on the upper management of Microsoft are not stupid people. They have released products available to other market niches when there was profit motive for those profit products.
Yeah, except this is not niche anymore. That's the big thing.
Yeah,
that unlike OS, you know, OS 10.
Still releasing current versions of Word for Unix. It's still being worked on.
Yeah, because that's not threatening any of their other product lines.
Well,
same thing with Apple's OS X. You know, they could put that on there, and they did put it on there, but it's not a threat to them. It's not going to take away.
Well,
the way that they make profit.
That's fine, Russ, but I've said this before on the show that, you know, and, you know, I can't give anybody names about this, but I know people inside Microsoft, and I have been told by these people on more than one occasion that Office or Linux has been flowcharted out long, long ago.
Right. And you haven't seen it.
Well, no, you won't see it until, you know, like I said, I'll agree with you in the short term, but in the long term, I can't agree with you. When those enterprises start changing over to Linux in extremely large numbers, Gates is just not a fool. He's going to release an Office product for Linux, or he's going to lose all of those, the, you know, the desktops to OpenOffice.
I think we're still talking a few years though down the road. My guess would be a minimum of 3 years
before we used to say things like desktop, the Linux on the desktop was 5-8 years away. Okay, you know, it ain't.
Yeah, no,
much faster than we ever anticipated it was going to happen.
Yeah, and a lot of the predictions that have been out there have been really, really off. Frankly, I haven't believed the real long time spans people are giving it. Linux on the business desktop is making an appearance in very short order.
It's now. It's not.
Yeah.
You know, it's not when. It's now.
I don't know if I mentioned on the show before, but I know I've talked to some people about this. But when I was at Linux World, I normally before I give my session, I do a little show of hands deal just to find out who I'm talking to. And as has been the case the last few shows, I was finding that probably 75-80% of the people were first time Linux World attendees. But what amazed me was that when I asked how many people are actually deploying, I've actually deployed Linux already. I got again somewhere in the 80% margin, and that's incredibly high. So we're beginning to see real business rollouts, not just leading edge adopters. And I happen to know for a fact that a number of those companies represented in that room were in the Fortune 100.
Yep. Well, that was
Russ. In your straw poll there, did you just distinguish between deploying and deploying on the desktop, or did you say just deploying?
I didn't get a chance to make that distinction there, but I did get the sense that there's, you know, I mean, this is serious stuff.
A lot of people are deploying Linux in the server farm and Linux in the server area and stuff like that, and with good reason. But that was specifically the desktop is of interest.
Yep. Even then, and I think this, as I recall, this is the third story, the one I couldn't remember. There is definitely motion going on that the analysts are not picking up on. And the third story, I think, had to do with is there room for Mandrake in the enterprise?
Yeah, I read that.
I forget where that's posted, but hopefully it's on the Linux Show webpage.
Yes, it is.
But the interesting thing there is that this kind of makes us remember that it's not a case where Linux has been successful because of SUSE and Red Hat and all these other players. Sure, they have played a part in it, but when it comes down to it, the success of Linux was being driven by other forces, and these companies, inside a large part, were sort of formed in reaction to what was going on. And we're seeing that, I think, again, with the whole desktop movement. We haven't had many Linux companies focused on Linux desktop. In fact, even ones like, you know, Red Hat have been saying up until recently that they're not interested in that right now, et cetera. But the real truth is, though, that it has been progressing, not inside the Fortune 100s up until recently, at least, but it had been progressing elsewhere, and it had been going, you know, low on the radar. Small business and a number of other organizations and so forth. So there's a lot of stuff that's actually going on that isn't being captured by the analyst numbers. And so I think that even players like Mandrake that have been neglected by a lot of the big corporate numbers are going to be, you know, potentially very significant in the near future, because there's a lot going on that isn't being detected and won't be recognized until you see Fortune 500 companies doing the rollout. But even then, that's going to be, I think, more reaction than driven.
Well, that even goes more to support the issue of will Microsoft Linuxize. It really even supports that contention even greater. Let's just take it, Russ, from a straightforward bean counter issue. You're within Microsoft. An operating system sells for $109. Office sells for $347. Are they going to throw caution to the wind in a fruitless attempt to save a commodity?
Well, the thing is, it's not one thing.
When Office
drives Windows, but it also drives literally every other product they have.
Yeah, but
break that link in every other product, and that includes all the enterprise stuff, when you think about it, comes into question. All of those things could suffer severe damage because the lock-in is broken. It's that critical.
Well, I mean, but they've been selling Office for Mac.
Yeah, but you see, Mac isn't going anywhere. For better or worse, Mac is a niche product.
Microsoft
what?
Isn't going anywhere either.
I'm breaking up here, so. But Mac is not a threat to them. But Linux is.
They don't see Macintosh as any threat to them. You mean?
You know, well, it's not taking the world. It's carving a larger, progressively larger place for itself, and that may have a lot to do with why they're kind of. Slowing down in that area, why they seem to be backing off in some respect. But Linux is coming on like a house of fire. And if it comes on, then suddenly not only does Windows lose, but Exchange loses. All of their enterprise stuff that they have put together, all this stuff that they're proclaiming is going to be, you know, bleeding edge, all of it falls like a house of cards because there's no reason to go there anymore. And in fact, if you give up Windows as the operating system, none of that stuff works. And that would mean that they'd have to take all of that, they'd have to port it all, and they would have to make it play well with others. And none of that is a corporate strength. They'd have to reinvent the corporation, which they are capable of doing, but I don't think that we're going to see it in the next 3 or 4 years.
The time frame for that would be very damaging to them.
Well,
yeah.
I certainly don't think they're going to do it completely based upon product per se. I think it's far more likely that Microsoft is going to do these kind of things by engineering the market rather than engineering the product.
They've always engineered the market instead of the product.
And that is a segue into one of the other stories that I'd like to throw into this mix because it fits very well with the Microsoft and Linux thread. And a very interesting email that was handed off to me today. It's posted on our website. The headline that we've thrown on the email is eBay in bed with Microsoft? And for those of you who are listening, so I'm just going to go ahead and I'm going to read this email because it's so short. Normally I don't like reading things. It's so short. It's from eBay customer service. It says, "Hello. I'm sorry that you've had problems using the eBay site. Please understand that as we go forward and make changes to our site, some systems are simply not able to keep up with technology changes." Okay, that's irritating comment number one. "One of these, I'm afraid, is Mozilla, which our software is not designed specifically for. We also do not support Linux. And more Linux users are finding eBay harder and harder to use. We recommend that you try a current Macintosh or PC. We apologize for any inconvenience or concern that this has caused, and we thank you for choosing eBay. Regards, Bridget, eBay Picture Service Support." I think every Linux user that has ever purchased anything on eBay could write eBay a seething letter right this minute for this blatant engineering of the market. They're basically telling this Linux user that passed me this email to just, you know, go stuff it. We're not going to support you and we have no interest in supporting you. Go buy a Macintosh or Microsoft product. I think that is a ridiculous thing for eBay to do. And, you know, something tells me that they didn't make this decision independently, because Linux is just growing too damn fast for them to make a sort of blatant disregard for a growing population of Linux. Anybody want to throw in a comment on that?
Well, I don't know about that. I there's always been this problem. You go to CNN, you even go to eWeek. Try to use your online subscription to eWeek with Linux. You can't do it. Okay, the online, if you want to read you have to get the dead tree version of eWeek. The published version that they publish for online, well, there's no reader for Linux. This comes down to open standards. It always has been an open standards thing. I mean, if there's no open standards, this is the kind of things you get locked out. You know, talk about lock in, this is lock out.
No, I completely agree with the open standards issue. But this is, I think this is going a little bit beyond just a simple standards issue I've seen lots of situations where this is the technology we're using right now. When we get enough Linux users, we will definitely, you know, focus in on that. There's always been at least an attempt to be polite about it. But there's no being polite about this. We're not going to support it, and we have no intention of supporting it. At least that's the attitude I'm getting out of this. I'm suspicious. I am suspicious of the source of this. So, I don't know.
Yeah, that whole thing is very disturbing, quite frankly. This was an email that was sent to some user?
Yeah, when you get back to your email, I sent everybody on the staff a copy of this email.
Yeah, because that is, there's something very strange going on there. Either it was clearly penned by someone with more than a trivial bias, and it would be interesting to find out if that's coming just from someone within their IT department who's basically a Microsoft head and doesn't have anything to do with it, or is it actually coming from higher in the food chain?
Yeah.
You know, is this something, just someone speaking to one person, or is this a concerted effort on the part of eBay to not support the platform?
Well, that's exactly the point.
Yeah, we need to find that out.
To the point, that's why we need to have lots and lots and lots of Linux users email eBay tonight.
There you go.
And ask them what's going on. What's this nonsense about not supporting Linux?
Yeah.
What's this nonsense about not supporting Mozilla? I mean, that not supporting Mozilla cuts out an awful lot of browsers.
Yeah, a lot of Mozilla-based browsers run on Windows, too.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a fact. And so this is just way too straight Microsoft party line.
I've seen some standard websites around that are saying that we recommend Internet Explorer, and please, we see that you don't have an Internet Explorer, and please use Internet Explorer.
Well, and the first thing I do when I see that, Ernie, is I try and find an email address for a business. Tell them that they've lost the business that they might have had.
Yeah.
My dollars are walking away from them because they're only supporting one particular protocol.
There you go. That's exactly what you have to do.
We got Eric Raymond on the line, just called in. Eric, hello, why have you called us?
Hi there.
Hi, what's up?
What's that strange background noise? It sounds like children playing or something.
Yeah, well, I'm at the airport, and I'm going to bow out now, so people have a little bit of peace and quiet here. Okay. Talk to you next week.
Yeah, Russ, feel free to call back on a payphone, though, if you want to.
Okay.
Because you can always muffle it.
So has everyone here seen the nice little torpedo that Novell just put below SCO's waterline today?
No, I didn't hear about that one.
Yes, I read about it shortly before the show.
Oh, this is good. This is actually a torpedo with two explosive charges, either one of which would be sufficient to blow their case out of the water. Explosive charge number one is one that we've been half expecting, which is that Novell is demanding that that under the terms of its contract, SCO has an obligation to cease enforcing their license terms if Novell directs them to do so, and Novell has directed them to cease pursuing the IBM and Sequent lawsuits by February 11th, which is tomorrow, and to notify Novell that they have done so. That one we were half expecting. The other one, which I had no clue was coming, and this is really interesting, one of the things that's been developing on Grok Law is that SCO has dropped its trade secret claims, and so their entire case now rests on this wacky interpretation of Clause 2.01 in the old AT&T license, which said that derivative works of Unix had to be considered part of the Unix product. Well, what I didn't know until about an hour and a half ago is that AT&T itself nuked that clause in 1985.
Oh, dear.
They sent a clarification to their license holders in a newsletter, which was supposedly went to all of their license holders, specifically disclaiming the theory that that clause gave them controller ownership rights in code developed by their license holders.
Oh. That's quite a torpedo.
Well, yes.
It took somebody going through a bunch of file cabinets to find this.
Somebody went through a bunch of file cabinets at Novell. That site of that newsletter and AT&T specifically in 1995 that clause doesn't mean what Daryl McBride thinks it does is in Novell's letter to SCO, and this changes the whole game. Because now it means that SCO has to go through Novell to get to IBM.
You have to, you mean SCO has to ask permission of Novell?
Yes.
Can we sue IBM?
First, they either have to get Novell's permission to sue IBM, or they have to demonstrate in court that the provision of their contract with Novell that says that Novell can require them to pursue an enforcement action is not binding on them.
Yeah, there's also a third part to this, and that is that SCO filed copyright on the Unix System 5 code. They refiled the copyright,
yeah,
including that code, which was is presently now called the BSD code, as well as the possible infringing Linux code. SCO subsequently has refiled copyright on it, and there's another clause in one of these contracts that passed down from AT&T, which would prevent, I don't have the legal wording in front of me, but it basically would prevent SCO from doing it because they really don't have clear legal authority over that code because it belonged to BSD, or at least there's contention of who did it really belong to.
Well, I mean, I thought this was already settled in court.
And yeah, it has been, and therefore it is illegal. It is a felony for SCO to file a copyright on something that they know they don't own. And so this could really end up big time blowing up in a bunch of people's face.
So, Jeff, what's your evidence that they've actually filed for a copyright that covers the BSD code? I hadn't heard anything about this.
When they would have done so when they refiled their blanket copyright. If you recall back towards the end of last summer,
yeah,
when Novell was saying, you know, we own the copyright. We still own the copyright. SCO filed for copyright at that moment.
I don't think
they did file a copyright.
I don't think you can deduce from their actions that they're claiming copyright over the BSD code.
In fact, recently I've read articles saying that they're trying to disavow the copyright thing.
Right, that's correct. And I think they're trying to disavow the copyright they filed because they made the copyright too broad.
Well, I think that we all know that they made the copyright too broad. But I'm just trying to figure out what the heck this means.
Anyway, this is a nice little torpedo below SCO's waterline, and it will be interesting to watch the water rush in.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting 3 or 4 days. I really think that this is pretty much over.
Is this going to require the judge to get into the courtroom pretty quickly or something? Or?
Well, there's a complication. Right now, they are not before the judge that will be trying that's supposed to be trying the actual case. They are before a judge that is tasked only to regulate the process of discovery.
Okay. Yeah. I kind of understood that.
So I have been informed from a reliable source that the discovery judge does not, in fact, have the authority to quash the case, much as she might want to.
I don't know that at all. So I'll just go on what your word is here. But for those of you who haven't seen the transcripts of the hearing from last Friday, you ought to go take a look at it. It's at Grokla. We got a link to it on the site tonight.
I just finished reading it.
Very interesting read. Very interesting read.
Boy, if you want to see a classic example of a lawyer wielding a knife so sharp that the other side barely realizes it has gone in, go read what David Marriott from IBM has to say in that transcript.
Yep.
He chooses his words very, very carefully.
Very carefully, very effectively, and it takes you a while to realize how much he's damaging the other side because he's not showboating. He's not pounding the table.
Yep. It would be interesting to hear a recording of that dialogue. I know they don't exist, but it would be interesting to hear a recording of it, to hear the voice used for this, because
his inflection,
the words are very powerful in of themselves.
Yes. Oh, I have no doubt that his comments were delivered in a very level, dry, and only very, very faintly sarcastic monotone.
Were you a fly on the wall, Eric?
No, it's just that's the impression I get from the transcript.
Yeah.
Now, the transcript is, it was a group effort. If you go out to the Grokla website, there was a whole bunch of people who participated.
I read a bunch of those, earlier in that development, and it was kind of fun to see it coming together.
Yep, because it took several people's notes to sort of chip everything together in an accurate format. We are up to 8:34 here in Chicago. I do want to sneak a couple more stories in besides Doe. Do you have anything else you want to say, Sco, Eric?
Nope, that was it.
Okay, well, feel free to hang out if you like. If not, it's been nice talking to you. Thanks for joining us, but don't go away if you don't want to. A couple other things on the list of things we wanted to get into the conversation tonight. One that I think is probably, an incredibly significant story, and that's the Evans Data Study report that there are now 1.1 million, now let's say it again, 1.1 billion developers in North America alone working on open source projects.
Jeff, I'm going to have more information on this shortly. When I saw that picture, when I saw that press release, I called their press contact, who immediately boggled, and said he was going to pass me on to their director of research, who would be happy to answer my questions about the study. So I expect to have a more detailed breakdown on those pictures shortly.
I would like to see that.
Yeah, it sounds remarkable. If it's indeed true. If it, the only way I can imagine it that it is true is that they're including every ancillary staffer who may have, you know, come in contact with an open source project. But
no, actually, I do not find this figure surprising.
Yeah, okay.
And let me tell you why. It's because 3 or 4 years ago, when I sat down to do an estimate, I looked at all the available figures, made conservative extrapolations. And at that kind of time, my estimate of the worldwide community was 750,000. It's not that big a jump from 750,000 to 1.1 million. I can easily believe that that represents 3 years' growth.
Yeah, but 750,000 in the world, that's easy to believe.
Yeah. Well, bear in mind the one-to-one ratio. Whenever you do assays on things like levels of internet activity, intensity of open source development, it's just about 50% in the U.S. and 50% elsewhere. So you basically take all the U.S. figures and multiply them by two.
And you've got the world.
Yeah. Now, what's happening, that's not going to remain true forever. The share of overseas activity is rising, but it's rising really slowly.
Except for in Finland.
Yes.
and New Zealand.
And New Zealand.
Well, in fact, those places account for most of the rise, or I should say more that Scandinavia, interestingly enough, Scandinavia and Germany account for a disproportionate amount of the rise in activity.
Yeah.
This is something that's come out in a couple different studies. Anyway, 1.1 is given their survey methodology, it's a nice hard number. If anything, I suspect it's probably an underestimate because their survey methodology is tuned to detect activity from people who are full-time professional developers. That means they're not going to catch students, they're not going to catch amateurs, and they're not going to catch contributing experts from other fields. So if anything, that 1.1 million is probably low.
And that last one, the contributing expert, is one that in open source could be non-trivial.
That's right. It can be very important. I've lost count of the number of times I've gone into archives and seen open source software. For example, one of my favorite examples was an open source package for calculating returns from financial derivatives that was actually written by a finance guy who programmed on the side.
Yeah, and he's an amateur, but he knows his stuff. He knows his technical stuff,
yeah.
And so he supports the project.
Anyway, the point is that 1.1 is a hard number. If anything, it's probably an underestimate, and it leads me to feel pretty confident with a worldwide figure of somewhere over 2.2 million developers. That's a big number.
Yep, there certainly is. A couple more quick stories I want to give reference to before we jump to the break and bring in John Terpstra is a couple links. Number one is the Foxfire browser is just been released from Mozilla. We've got a link up on the site if you want to download the 0.8.
Called Firefox.
The 0.8 version. Go out there and grab it. I've already downloaded it, haven't installed it yet, but I've already got it, and I'm going to install it after the show tonight.
Is it available as an RPM?
I don't know. I have no clue. I didn't look.
Yeah. This is supposed to be the next generation of Mozilla? Is that the theory?
No. It's the former Firebird, and since there was a database called Firebird, they renamed it to Firefox. And
it is their next browser.
It's the browser I use at school on Windows.
It's the next version of Mozilla browser.
So tell me, as a reasonably contented Mozilla user, why should I switch to Firefox?
It's smaller.
Huh?
It's smaller.
Ah.
It's unbelievably tiny in size.
Yeah, it's very.
When I saw the number of megabyte size it was, I'm going, they can really make a browser that small? I was pretty surprised.
So what did they cut out, the mailer?
I have no clue.
They don't have separate apps. They have separate apps. They don't have a bundled apps.
I see.
Which is just a browser, you know.
One more story I want to sneak in there is the big press releases today announcing the open of the Dell Linux Engineering website. We have a link up there. I'm not necessarily recommending anybody go to the Dell Linux Engineering website unless perhaps you are really in the mood for being totally underwhelmed.
Oh, you mean their new weblog? The one that was put up by one of their engineers?
Yeah.
Well, that's an amateur effort. I mean, this is one of my links that I had at home. Dell Computer has got, one of Dell Computer's engineers is putting up a Linux website.
It's Dell Linux Engineering.
Yeah, and Dell is allowing it to continue, which means something's happened at Dell.
Well, it'll be evidence to me that they can sell water in a desert.
Well, yeah, I know. I mean, it's just started. Let's see what happens.
Okay, yeah, fine. But as I said, if you need to be totally underwhelmed, go to this website.
Yeah.
Okay.
Flashdot was underwhelming at the beginning too.
Yeah.
So.
That's true.
Let's give him some time.
Okay. Well, we need to take a quick break. Everybody, hang in there. Kevin, put on a tune. We'll be back in about 3 minutes with segment number two, with John Terpstra talking about Samba, his book, and the Open Standards Alliance. So everybody, hang in there. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
segment number two of the Linux Show for February 10th, 2004. We have been having a jolly old time chatting in between segments. Our guest this evening is John Terpstra. If you were listening to our broadcast from Linux World Expo, by the way, for those people who have been harassing me to get the archives from Linux World Expo up, they are up. They're a little bit difficult to find. They're all the way on the bottom of the archive page. I do have a chart organized that we're going to put them on a separate page to make it a little bit easier to find individual segments. We'll get that taken care of this week. But the archives from the expo are up, so quit bugging me about them, okay? But anyways, John was one of our guests on the Linux World Conference and Expo live broadcast. Actually, John was on our show twice, once talking about Samba and another time talking about this idea that popped into his head that he just sort of wanted to spew over the airwaves. And so we had John join us twice. So welcome back, John. Boy, three times in 2 weeks. That's pretty good, huh?
Time flies too quickly when you're having fun, Jeff.
That's right. But big day for you personally and Samba as a project with the 3.0.2 version coming out, and your books seem to be on target for their releases. Is the official Samba 3X that is now on the bookstore stands available right now?
The official Samba 3 How to and Reference Guide's been out since the 24th of October, and Samba 3 by Example is due to be available, due to start shipping around the 26th of March. I'm not supposed to publish that date, but hang it, you know. We're committing this thing to open source, so we might as well tell people it's going to happen.
Yeah, I saw an advanced copy of the Samba by Example book at Linux World Conference and Expo. It's too long of a name, guys. They got to shorten it back to Linux World Expo. It's
Use the acronym.
LWE. They don't like
LWC. It's Lewis.
They don't like LWE anymore either. But anyways, I saw a copy of Samba 3 by Example. That's a neat little book. It has some really simple what's the word for it? Test cases, examples of how to set up very specific examples of using Samba. It's just literally like a cookbook.
Well, I'll tell you what, Jeff. If you don't tell any of the folks out there, I'll let you in on a secret.
Okay.
Those example networks are real world networks. They're not fictitious.
Oh, they are?
Well, it was too difficult to create a real phantom. There is one phantom. That's Chapter 7. That's the 2,000 user network. And truly, it was too difficult to make that a really big phantom case. If you look carefully at the book, you'll see that Chapter 7 gives good guidance, but it's nowhere near as detailed and nowhere near as complete as Chapters 2 through to 6.
Uh-huh.
Because they document a real-world network, so there was not too much that I had to imagine. All I had to do was update a few files, and we were ready to roll.
And correct me if I'm wrong, are your two books, okay, these are both Prentice Hall books, and are these part of the...
They are part of the Bruce Perrins open source.
Okay, yeah, the Bruce Perrins open source series. That's the label I was looking for.
Yeah. You know, the documentation came, the need for improved documentation really struck home around December 2002. But when you start from so far behind the eight ball, no one wants to really own up to the fact that there's so much work to do. And I didn't set out to write a 700-plus page book. I set out to start writing and start documenting a bit, and I thought in 2 weeks' time I'll be done with this.
How long did it take?
Famous last
7 months.
No, how long did it take, really?
It took 7 months of writing, full time.
Full time?
Yeah.
And how much of that was the first draft, and how much of that was the edit and going through the mill?
It was all through the mill. There weren't any drafts. All of this was committed to CVS as we were developing it.
That's
so we had people giving us feedback. We had, you know, I'm deeply indebted to about 50 reviewers, many of whom stuck with us all the way through the process. And, of course, many of them expressing... People in the open source world don't have opinions. You know that, Jeff.
Don't make me laugh.
One of the strongest opinions I got all the way through is, you know, when are you going to write Chapter 2? Well, the moment people saw, the reviewers saw Chapter 2, Chapter 2 is not in the public CVS yet. The moment they saw Chapter 2, they said, well, dang it, you should have had that at the end of every chapter.
Oh my God.
Well, that was 18 pages by 40 chapters. That's insane. That's another book.
Yeah.
So the Samba 3 by Example book is a... I consciously did not want to write another Lethal Weapon, another book that you could throw at someone and kill them with.
John, I had a similar experience recently. When I was working on the Art of Unix Programming, as I had just about finished it, Addison Wesley told me, well, we want a teaching guide with exercises.
Hey, I'm with you.
That turned out to be more work to write than the book. Boy, that was difficult.
Well, the Samba 3, by example, actually only took 2 months to write. I just killed myself writing it.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear you. I've been there.
But I knew what I was going to write because I got strong feedback. I did a lot of research. I rang around. I spoke with network admins. I looked at what our target market... pardon me for jumping around here, but one of the big problems we have in the open source community is we tend to preach to our own. Hang it, we know the story already. We know why we're doing these things. What I want to see is new converts into the camp.
Yeah.
Where are we going to get those converts from? Not from the Unix world. We've got to get them from the Windows world.
And
so I started... Hmm?
Sorry. Keep going.
So I started polling Windows network admins for what they wanted to see. Many of them have heard about Samba. Samba's got a really good reputation. Well, there are a few who have heard negative stories, but... Hey, listen, let's put that aside. That's a separate issue. The guys who have heard a positive story, many of the Windows guys are quite afraid of playing with Linux. It's something they don't know. It's a black box to them. So the feedback I got was very strong. Look, you know, anyone can stick in a CD and install it, but after that CD is finished installing, what do I do next?
How do I keep it going?
No, how do I finish the installation so I've got Samba working?
Right.
So Samba 3, by example, every chapter starts off with the assumption that you've just finished installing. You know, the CD's just stopped working. It's just finished installing. Now what do you do next? Follow these steps and you've got a working network.
Right.
Yep. And Samba 3, by example, is all built around Samba 302.
This is a how many page how to?
John, here's something entertaining for you. I actually know somebody who uses Samba on all Unix setups because he thinks it's easier to configure than shared file systems.
Right. Well, good on him, Bob. I hope he keeps thinking that.
This is some evidence that you guys have done your work well.
Well, you know, the Samba project is a mature project that's come along a long way. And what we've been doing over the course of the 2.0 or 2.x series is auto-tuning as much of the thing as possible. Once upon a time, you had to set 40, 50 different parameters in your SMB.conf file.
Yeah.
Most of those are auto-tuning. You can override them. If you're a Unix admin and you know what you're doing, you can plug in whatever you like. We'll respect your judgment. You know it better than we do. But for those who don't, for the largest part, it's auto-tuning. There are you can get away in most networks with probably no more than half a dozen to a dozen configuration parameters in the global section. That makes it a lot more usable.
Yeah.
So we're winning the usability stakes.
I'm already getting a lot of feedback from the school I teach at. I just introduced them to Samba, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. And I've been trying my damnedest to convert this college to using more and more Linux. And I tell you, it really wasn't until I showed them Samba that I really got anywhere with these guys. And I set them up with a beta of Samba 3, and it's remarkable how easy it is to set up. It really is.
Well, it is and it isn't. It's made somewhat complicated by the fact that you have those Windows clients, and those Windows clients can do some pretty funky things. And to make it all hum and buzz properly, there's an amazing amount of work you need to do, like creating, for example, roaming profiles that are mandatory that the user can't mess around with and break. If you Outlook or Outlook Express, you know, you can end up storing your PST files on your profile. You there still?
Yeah, okay.
So I've seen profiles that are over a gigabyte in size.
Really?
Well, every time you log onto the network, that whole gigabyte of profile downloads to the workstation. Every time you log out, it has to write that whole thing back to the profile share. That's broken. You know, that means logging on and logging off takes forever. No wonder people get frustrated. Well, the way you get around that is by doing what's known as folder redirection. So you stuff that stuff onto a network drive so you never have to pass that information over the network during log-on and log-off. You just access it over a network drive. You drop performance a little bit whilst you're using it, but at least it makes the log-on and log-off process something that's palatable and manageable. So all of that stuff is now documented in Samba 3 by example. That was only alluded to in the two chapters on policy management and profile management in Samba in the how-to. So the how-to covers the theory. The Samba 3 by example now gives it to you in hard, reproducible, step-by-step form so that you can implement that stuff without having to think about it and without having to decode what is not always really intuitively obvious.
Uh-huh. Okay. Now, let's segue over. There's another reason I know you wanted to come on tonight.
Yeah, I'd like to just talk very briefly about Samba 3 and
okay.
the 302 release, if I may, Jeff.
Sure.
And that is, I spoke with Jerry Carter today and said, Jerry, you know, I'm on air tonight. What do you want me to say? And he said, well, make it up. I said, well, okay, well, what I'll say then is that we have been absolutely thrilled with the stability of Samba 3.0.0. And really, the 301, why have we got this 301 and 302 in relatively short succession? And I think that's a question that our users have asked, and that deserves an answer. So I don't want to waste too much time on that, but 301 basically fixed a whole bunch of minor little things that were bugging people. We implemented a new bug tracking system with Samba 3, and we've encouraged people to file any issue, any concern at all that they have should be filed on bugzilla.samba.org.
So you even got some code from me, I believe.
Well, that's possible. We've had about 1,000 reports, which is wonderful. Not all of them are valid bugs, but I'd rather see that any issue that anyone has, I'd rather see it reported there so we have a record of it and we can act on it, we can look at it. And if it is a non-issue, it's not a problem. We can just say, okay, that case is closed. Next. But at least that way we now have in Bugzilla a means of capturing every little glitch and issue that people have. And we want to squash those things. So we started to do that in 301. And in 301, we had the only really significant, that is, major biting problem, that some people experienced problems with the new secure channel support. And we tried to fix that in 301, and we didn't quite get it right. We introduced some new bugs. So 302 is a bug fix on a bug fix. I know that sounds awful, but in essence, what we've tried to do in 302 is to fix that little glitch and to stabilize the product further. And
we see this happening in the Linux kernel too. Is that there'll be a major release, and then very quickly they'll come out. There will be like two or three quick releases right after that.
Yeah, except in our
common situation.
Yeah, in our case, we waited 3 months. We didn't have anything that was really urgent that pressed us to do this. But then when we released a fix, we messed a couple of little things up that bit a few people, and for that reason, we've just hurried up and gotten 302 out. And 302 is a stabilization release, and it should be fine for most people to use. So I said to Jerry, well, what are we going to do? Jerry's the release manager. He controls the whole program, you know, and if he gets it wrong, then the whole team shouts at him, and then he has to figure out, you know, why am I being shouted at? You know the rigmarole. But 303, Jerry asked me to make certain that I pointed it out very clearly that there will be a 303 release before there'll be a 3.1. We're not announcing the 3.1 feature set at this stage, but 303 will have a new feature that a lot of people have asked for, and that is forced password lockout capability. That's when the password change must be made, it will force the lockout if someone doesn't change their password. That's a very important security feature. The other thing that will be in 303 is Jeremy Ellison's been working on a fix for the Kerberos key tab handling. That will be in 303. And for the rest, the only other thing that we are foreshadowing 303 to do is further stabilization. And the time frame for 303 is in the 8 to 12 week period. So, yeah, I'm kind of putting my flag up and waving it and saying probably sometime in May. Probably after the Samba XP conference in Germany, because we will have had an opportunity to all get together and sit around the table and, yeah, eat a steak or so and munch things over, literally and figuratively, and decide what we want to put into 303, and then soon after Samba XP, we'll get to work on it and then get that baby out.
Okay. Well, why don't we talk a few minutes before the show actually ends. Let's sneak in a couple of minutes discussion on your open standards initiative that started up a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, I'd like to thank the folks who have bothered to get in touch. A few have. One suggestion in particular made a lot of sense, and that is, why talk about it? This is the open source world. You're measured not by what you say, but by what you do. So as a result of that, we've kicked off the suggested initiative of forming an open standards alliance. And I'm now looking for three
warning,
or four people.
Warning, acronym collision. You just collided with the other OSAs, the open source awards.
Uh-oh. Well, we can change the name. In any case, what we want to do is set up a group that is a help group that will help open source projects that are not necessarily Linux-centric, that want to get their project standardized, that want to get public standards in place, basically to help them to go through the process.
Ever since we talked about this, at the expo. I think this has got, the more I think about it, the more valid I think that this really is. The point that you were making a couple weeks ago was that people become de facto standards 9 times out of 10, not because they are indeed a true standard, like an IEEE standard, but because they say so. There is really no metric that is established for measuring what quantifies you as a standard for this industry group. And so I think this is an idea that really does have some merit to it in helping us wade through the future of establishing some open standards.
Do you mean other than the Internet Engineering Task Force?
Wherever possible, we want to act as a body that will push people to existing standards. We don't want to go creating a plethora of standards. We want to use the existing bodies. And all that we are tuning into here is those projects that are not specifically Linux-centric.
There you go. But there's a lot of standards on the in place already. I mean,
absolutely.
And
we do not want to reinvent. We don't have time for that.
I agree.
Yeah, but we're not. At least I don't want to put words in John's mouth, but we're not talking here about W3 consortium standards or IEEE standards or IEEE standards, I should say. Those are legitimate standards that are created by a peer review group.
Correct.
And so those standards have validity. They have a metric by which they are measured. And right now there is this illusion that the protocols and other closed standards, and here again I'm using that word standards, that Microsoft is presently using and are touting as industry standards are only that because Microsoft says so.
I think I'd like to differentiate between dominant practices and open standards.
That's correct.
I like that word, dominant practices.
Right. And one of the evangelism jobs that I think we need to do in with respect to open standards is to sell the world the idea that it ain't an open standard unless it has an open source reference implementation.
Correct. Absolutely.
That's exactly good.
Well, it should be, I think, pushed one step further. It clearly isn't a standard if the only opportunity to make use of that protocol is from a single source, closed source vendor.
But when you're doing this kind of evangelism, it's better not to go negative. It's better to point out where the good thing is than where the bad thing is.
The good thing is that in having open public standards, publicly refereed standards, then the same public that is involved in creating that standard ends up being a watchdog for long-term interoperability.
Right.
In other words, it's a safeguard for the end user to not become isolated.
And that is precisely where open source reference implementations are valuable. And that, my friends, is a message we can sell to Wall Street.
Yes, it is.
Well, I know you want to find people to work with you on this, so how can people get in contact with you?
People can get in touch with me by emailing me, jht@openstandardsalliance.org.
Okay.
Red alert, acronym collision imminent.
Yeah, as soon as we get a team together, we'll look at whatever we need to do to avoid that namespace collision.
I don't think it's actually very serious, but you should look into the problem.
Sure.
Okay, well, We are up to the end of the show. John, thank you. And Eric, thank you for hanging out as well.
Hey, guys, it's been fun.
It's always enjoyable to have you on the show. You're welcome back anytime at all.
Well,
in fact, the next time we got you on the show, we really ought to talk about what you really do for a living. Because I don't think we've ever mentioned either one of the companies that you're a part of. Ever.
They're a secret, maybe, huh?
I don't think so.
I work for Primastasis. It's my own business.
Yeah. So next time you're on, we'll talk about your business so people could know that you've got a real job.
Oh, yeah. Well, I wonder what's real. I do what is fun. I enjoy what I do.
Well, that's part of this whole gig, I guess, is this IT gig allows you to develop your own little niche and your own little universe to go play in. That's what I certainly like about it. But I'd like to take a few minutes just to thank all the listeners out there for stopping by. It's real important that you continue to spread the word. If you haven't noticed, we got a couple of more mirror sites up this week. We will be adding a couple of more mirror sites very shortly. I've been getting a lot of emails very recently of people who have been requesting a PeerCast mirror. We have come to the conclusion that we are not going to do it. However, you listeners, if you would like to see PeerCast established as one of our protocols, we will certainly cooperate with you in getting a PeerCast mirror set up. So if you would like to contact us at staff@thelinuxshow.com, we'll get hooked up with you and we'll figure out how to get all the logistics worked out. But the next theoretically live performance that we're going to have is next week at this time. Keep an eye out for us, for the news about us. If you're in the general Utah area, we might, this is probably about a 95% closed deal right now, we might be doing a live performance the third week of March in the Salt Lake City area at the Salt Palace. There's a conference being held out there that week. We'll give you more information about that during the next couple of weeks.
Can I drop an impromptu on you here, Jeff?
Sure.
I'm doing a presentation at the Provo Unix Users Group at BYU on the 19th of this month.
The 19th of February?
19th of February.
Okay, so if you're in the Salt Lake market, they can just go on the Internet and contact the Provo User Group?
Provo Unix Users Group.
Provo Unix Users Group. Okay. No problem at all. So, until next week, everybody, check us out. This has been the Linux Show for February the 10th, 2004. We'll see you all next week. Until then, we are out of here.